Spencer, how many miles did you ride on your bicycle this past week?
Not that many. I went to a wedding, had some other stuff going on. It was a little snowy at the start of the week. Maybe I might have gotten 50 miles.
Well, 50 miles is the magic number, as listeners of the Vel News podcast may know, because our sponsor, Health IQ, uses 50 miles a week of riding as the
benchmark.
And if you ride 50 miles a week, you can get $500,000 in life insurance coverage, starting at just $20 a month with Health IQ. To see if you qualify, you can go to healthiq.com/VeloNews. Spencer, why do we like Health IQ?
Health IQ has been sponsoring our podcast for quite some time now, and they just provide a great service to cyclists like you and I, and an affordable way to do life insurance.
Yeah, it's for cyclists, runners, vegans, swimmers. Basically, if you're a healthy person, then Health IQ can get you a great rate on life insurance because they work with healthy people like us. So remember, 50 miles, healthiq.com/VeloNews. Let's get on with the podcast. It's the VeloNews podcast. I'm Fred Dreyer here in the completely redesigned VeloNews podcast studios. And by completely redesigned, I mean we have a round table now that allows us to stare at each other. It is a wonderful Monday in Boulder, Colorado. I'm joined in this redesigned studio by Spencer Paulison. Hello, Spencer.
Hey, Fred.
How was your weekend?
It was pretty nice. Good fall weather here in Colorado. No more snow.
You went to a bike racer wedding.
I certainly did.
Recovering from your bike racer wedding?
I feel all right today.
Okay.
Yesterday was a little shaky.
Yeah. Good. I'm gonna keep my eye on you. Dane Cash, you are also here. Dane, how was your wedding? How was your weekend?
My weekend was great. Yeah, there was no wedding in my weekend, but it was great. Went on a little hike other side of the divide. It was lovely. Fall colors. Yeah.
Just everything is just great in Colorado
right now.
I love it. Guys, we have a very special guest. We have a real life pro bike racer in the flesh.
He's even wearing his kit, so we know which one it is.
In the room right now. And that is Robin Carpenter of the Rally Pro Cycling Team. Yay, Robin. Hello,
hey.
Robin. Welcome to the studio.
Thank you.
Robin, you're also in town for a bike racer wedding. What was your bike racer wedding like?
Oh, it was pretty much the same as all bike racer weddings, I think.
Yeah?
You know, only talking to the cyclists.
Yeah, talking to cyclists. Maybe have like two drinks and do some dancing on the dance floor and fall asleep at 8.
Yeah, two drink maximum for sure.
Well, Robin is in the studio. We're going to talk to Robin all about his year of racing because you had a very exciting year of racing. I believe it was about a year ago I did an interview with you, and you talked about the excitement and anticipation of going and doing European road races, and you did your share, I would say. You did a pretty good amount of European racing this year.
Yeah, I totally delivered. We had an awesome time. We did some super awesome races.
Well, and you spent like a lot of those races in the breakaway.
How else am I going to do anything in those races, man? I've got nothing else.
Yeah. So we're going to talk to Robin about what it was like to be in the European breakaways. First, guys, we got some news to get to. News. We had Cyclocross World Cup go on this past weekend in Switzerland. Spencer, what happened in that World Cup?
It was kind of a new venue. It was in Bern, Switzerland. A bit of a weird scheduling thing. World champion Wout van Aert actually wrote an opinion column about how it was not scheduled well because the day before it was a super prestige, which is really important for those Belgian racers especially, and then they had to go right to Switzerland. Some of them skipped the super prestige in favor of the World Cup, but it was I wasn't a big fan of this race. It looked that the course was kind of had some weird curby things, and it didn't help that it was just dusty and dry, kind of your typical early season cross race, but meant that it was kind of a bit of the dirt time trial that Dane hates so much. Marianne Vos did have a good battle with Anne-Maria Wurst. Worst best name in cycling.
Every time I read that, I'm like, Anne-Maria. Like,
lost in translation.
Bad bike racer name.
Well, maybe if you spoke Dutch, you would understand it better, Fred. You should be a little more culturally sensitive. So Marianne Vos wins like you would expect her to. And man, I'm telling you, she's going to win the World Cup and World Championships this year. She's on a tear and is focused on cross for the first time in a few years. And then in the men's race, Matthew Vanderpoel rides away with this. Was such a boring race. Matthew Vanderpoel just was off the front for like 7 laps by himself, just riding. And Wout van Aert was like 5 seconds behind the whole time. And Van Aert, unfortunately, was back there because he had a drop chain fairly early in the race, which I think, I don't know, I don't see him beating Vanderpool in this type of race to begin with, but it certainly doesn't help when you drop a chain. Like, a few guys had drop chains, actually. It was sort of a thing. I don't understand why these guys are still having this issue come up, but apparently apparently it's a problem, even if it's dry and dusty like the Swiss race.
It's a trend story, you know?
Yeah. Just,
that's a cool thing to do in European cyclocross right now. Well, yeah. Did you drop your chain? Yes, me too. Coming up in the women's race, Catherine Compton. Katie Compton.
Yeah, Katie third Compton. Place. Third, I should say. Very good ride for her. And also in the top 10, our Canadian friend, Magalie Rochette.
So, excellent.
Yes, good to see her showing up at the World Cups in Europe.
We had some road racing go on, too, with the Tour of Guangxi final World Tour race of the year.
Yeah, last one.
Guangxi, you really don't care about this race. I feel bad. It looks like a very difficult race. We have a piece on the site, too, about how it is the bridge between East and West. Dane, what can you tell us about what happened there in Guangxi?
Well, Guangxi had basically one big climber day. The fourth stage was the queen stage, and the other days were for the sprinters, so you got to see a nice little showcase of sprinting talent. Guys like Dylan Groenewegen, who we've seen all year. Fabio Jakobsen won two stages for Quickstep, bringing their total of stage wins to 1,007, I don't know, something really large. But Johnny Moscon was your race winner. He won the queen stage and then held on throughout the rest of the race. So everybody's favorite Italian sky rider, Johnny Moscon.
Fan favorite. Yeah.
Yeah.
I saw some stories about how this was like a redemption win for him. And I'm like, how does winning Tour of Guangxi make up for punching people in the head and using racial slurs?
Yeah, not sure about
that. Is there like a direct correlation there?
Just jock culture.
Yeah, yeah. It's true. Just winning, just being good.
Yeah.
We had a story on the site talking, yeah, about how this Tour of Guangxi is the latest race to try and bridge between East and West. It's owned by Dalian Wanda, which used to own Velo News in an indirect way.
For a hot minute.
We were the key asset of Dalian Wanda's global sports assets. But this made me think about the Outer Line stories that we had on the site earlier this year about the original Tour of China in the early 90s and how that also was seen as a bridge between East and West. And it was sponsored by some giant like cigarette company. Yeah. And there were all these just wacky tales of what it was like to put a bike race on in China back then.
Cigarette sponsorship's a nice, it's a good time.
Richmond Worlds had a big cigarette sponsor. That went off without a hitch, so.
Really?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah. Tobacco belt, you know, that's what you got to do.
Dane, our resident Virginia.
That's right.
Dane's smoking two cigarettes right now.
That's just how I roll when I podcast. Yeah.
Flavor country.
Yeah.
I think this race is interesting because so many World Tour team sponsors actually do have interests in China at the moment. You know, EF talking about how they have some big office over there. Some of the other sponsors say, you know, they have business interests in China. Whether or not the Tour of Guangxi will help these companies execute on their business goals in China, I guess that's a big yet to be seen.
Well, and there was also, I think, an announcement recently about a new Chinese team that got brought online the last week. I didn't really look too closely into that.
Yeah, planning into 2019, I think, to bring that team live. But I think one thing with this race that maybe is a way in which it'll be different from past forays into China, the riders seem to have enjoyed it. And I mean, when a lot of the stories that I've seen talking to riders who are over there make it sound like it's been a really nice experience. And you did not hear a lot of that about Tour of Beijing. Yeah. People seem to really dislike going there. So that could help.
Well, they had really nice pagodas. Like, I was checking out Gregor Brown's Instagram feed. Gregor was over there covering it for us. And every other photo was some like just gorgeous lit up pagoda that Gregor was hanging out underneath. Like, his Instagram pagoda game was just really on point. Kudos to you, Gregor. No one else liked the pagoda photos.
It's pretty obscure.
Hey, you know, it's like what was that website that just had photos of barns in like the middle of nowhere, or cabins?
Yeah, I like barns.
Yeah, cabins and barns and pagodas.
I could get into barns.
I like the video of Rigoberto Urán dancing that we got on Twitter.
Oh my gosh,
the weekend.
Yeah, that was amazing.
Big. Yeah.
The best part is that he's dancing to this Latin song and he just looks so natural and great. And then he grabs the mic and starts singing and it's like,
he was feeling it.
Yeah, whatever. Kudos to you, Rigoberto. All right, that's the news. The other piece of news, obviously, that I alluded to at the beginning of the podcast is that it's wedding season. It's bike racer wedding season. October is the official time for bike racers to tie the knot. Robin, you tied the knot a year ago in October. Why is this month such a special month for bike racers and holy matrimony?
Because apparently our only friends are also pro bike racers who are on the same exact schedule as all of us. Yeah, it's a I think October 1 is officially the start, but you're still you know, run a risk of missing some of your buddies, you know, depending on how important they are. If you're still racing Japan or China.
Is it a matter of, like, that is the time of year when you're able to actually, like, you know, you don't have to worry about training, for
example. Cut loose?
Yeah.
Yeah, probably. I think it's mostly about, like, scheduling. You got everybody who's just, I mean, lining up a group of friends that who are all racing, you know, in, like, professional circuit during the year is just about impossible. Like, you can't, it's just always convenience, so... Yeah, fall weddings. I don't know a single cyclist who hasn't gotten married in either a fall or sometimes a winter wedding, but, you know, yeah, October is generally the month to do it.
So you were able to do this race, but it sounds like there may have been conflicts to begin with. Like, you guys were thinking about doing some – Rally was thinking about doing some races later in the year, but then the schedule opened up. What was that like for you?
Oh, yeah. Actually, I thought I was supposed to be in Gwangju right now, but I think they figured out that – if Jonas and Pat are the ones planning next year and they have to keep working until November, next year's just not going to happen. So I think they just sort of scrubbed the whole like last month of the schedule, which is, you know, it's fine. I don't think.
Did the team actually have an invite?
I think we definitely had one to Turkey. And I think China was like a maybe, but I think they were talking like hardcore about going to Turkey, which I don't know, would have been interesting. Yeah. At the very least.
I heard it was a different organizer this year at Turkey, which meant it was like a little less smooth than in years past.
I did hear some complaining about some like non-world tour stuff going on, like in terms of standards.
So, yeah, long like transfers.
Unsafe, maybe.
That sort of stuff. Yeah, it's a tricky one because that race has always been hit or miss. I mean, at one point I remember, I think it was a spring race, and then they had to push it to the fall because of organizational challenges, and then... all the security concerns in Turkey, it's a little patchy in that way too. So it does make you wonder with the World Tour, like when are they going to really like kind of try to slap some serious standards on these
races?
Well,
there's so many races.
Yeah.
So many.
Yeah, they've added more and more, and that makes it hard to control them all, I think.
Spencer, you were at a bike racer wedding too.
I sure was.
Like, what's the typical like ebb and flow of bike racer wedding?
Well, a lot of the bike racers I know, you know, they live their lives in extremes where it's like you're racing intense, 100%, just balls to the walls, or you're laying in a hotel room, not doing anything at all. And so I feel like when it comes time for the off season, like Robin's saying, when everyone sort of has a minute to catch their breath, go home and everything, they sort of need that intensity at some point when maybe they don't usually get it. So it's like, let's drink heavily. Really fast and just make this happen. And plus they're all like 135 pounds, very skinny. It leads to some excess, which it's always pretty entertaining.
And
I think.
At 8,500 feet.
Yeah. The wedding I went to was, yes, it was very high altitude. So that affects them as well. Although, you know, they're probably better than most in that respect.
I heard yours was a little more lit than mine.
Okay. Well, you know, we don't want to, you know, don't want to kiss and tell or anything. No, so we're not going to call anyone out. But yeah, it was fun though. It was cool.
With your wedding, Robin, like, so I planned a wedding and I was married last year too. And I remember, you know, having to do some, you know, planning around like being at the Tour de France and being on the road. And, you know, thanks to my wife for picking up a lot of that slack because I was, you know, different time zones and focusing on getting yelled at by French gendarmes. But what I think that speaks to the larger question of like, how is it to plan basic domestic, like, everyday life things when you are a bike racer who's on the road all the time? How do you navigate that?
I guess you just kind of get it done when you can. You know, you come back, you have a rest week, and then it's just not really a rest week because you're just doing way too much other life stuff. I always run into that problem on like recovery days or like days with extended like periods of time, no training. You're just like, oh, I have all this other stuff that's been like ramming up my to-do list and I'll just get all that done. And then you know, by the end of the day, you're just like, oh my goodness. What have I done to myself? This is like a whole nother day of training.
So like there's, you know, you're like not just sitting around with your legs up all the time when you're not on your bike.
I mean, maybe some guys like, but I'm, you know, my wife's a scientist and she's always in the lab doing research. And so I'm the one who I'm the like the kept man, stay-at-home houseboy. So I get all the domestic work done.
I just assumed you guys had handlers to, like, do all your chores and go pick up groceries and, like, you know, that type of stuff.
Maybe in the world tour.
Well, Natalie's pro-continental now, right? I mean, that, isn't that what you get when you go up to that level?
Yeah, I'm now pro, quote.
Yeah, there you go.
So, Robin, you've been on the radar for a lot of Villa News readers for a number of years. You were famously on Hincapie team. You won a stage of the old USA Pro Challenge. You've won stages at Utah. You won over Alberta overall. You've had a tremendous amount of success in the domestic scene. And I remember a question that I had for you was like, you were the guy who had the level of success where in a previous generation of domestic racing, you would have been taken to the Pro Tour, to the World Tour, based off of those results. You know, the landscape that we're in these days with so few opportunities to get to that point, you know, after your Colorado stage win, that didn't happen. I'm curious, you know, thinking back to those periods of your career, was that a huge goal of yours? What was your emotional response like when you did have some of these successes, but then, you know, you didn't get taken up to the World Tour?
I think early on it was not like a super huge goal just because I tried to, you know, just be realistic. I went to school and wasn't one of like the super juniors who was on the national team and then the U23 team this whole 4 years. So I was like, you know, and you see everybody else who's doing that and those are the ones who get the call up. So it was like kind of just trying to remain realistic. Plus, you know, I've never been like the power guy, you know, I'm just the sneaky guy. And they don't, I think a lot of the World Tour teams, when they're looking at guys to bring up, they're looking at like the watts per kilogram. They're looking at the repeatability of efforts after, you know, 3000 KJs. And funny story about that. Actually, I think it was the end of last year, maybe the year before that, I had an agent who was talking to a World Tour team, who had successfully like negotiated offers for other riders, other prominent riders my age. And the World Tour team wanted to see my training peaks, see my numbers. And so we shared the training peaks account. Like you can just, you know, shove all your data at them at once. And then I didn't really hear back from them for a little while. And I was a little confused. And so was my agent. My agent told me, well, you know, every time I've shared the numbers, every time the team's asked for numbers and I've shared the numbers, you know, we always get an offer. We didn't hear a word back. So, yeah, I mean, it's not a huge deal. I kind of made a hard push that year to try to like negotiate with teams or like really put all the feelers out. Yeah, I don't know. It's all right. Not too concerned about it. I'm really, really stoked to be with Rally.
I always thought it was weird because I looked at the wins that you had and, you know, yeah, there was an element of sneakiness to them, but there was also some, I don't know, He-Man effort there. I think back to your stage win at the Tour of Utah 2016, and it was a hard day and you were in a breakaway and they, you know, the domestic teams put their strongest guys on the front to try and bring you and Ruben Campioni back and it didn't happen. And I was like, holy cow, this guy is... You ended up winning, and it was like these two are extremely strong, and Robin, the guy who's taking the big pulls and winning at the end, is really strong. You know, how do you go about winning races? What's the typical way by which Robin Carpenter wins a race?
Man, it's either going to be from that early break that somehow like sneaks away with too much time, or it's a late break. So, for example, in that Utah stage, one of the reasons why we had so much time was because the first hour of that race was like that. They've done that stage a couple of times, but usually there's a bunch more racing before you get to this section called the Hogsback, which is down in Escalante. But that year they started it in Escalante and then we were immediately on the hardest part of the course. And the race was just totally exploded, which is why it was only two of us, because everybody was like, nah, I'm okay with not doing that. But then it took ages for the yellow jersey to come back to the front. And, you know, that's the team that's going to control. They're going to ride. Everybody's waiting for the yellow jersey to come back. And so by the time we got to the top of Boulder Mountain, we had 8 minutes. But the other way, late break, perfect example of that, where I didn't actually win, but came close, was in Denmark this year. There was one of these stages where all those stages actually kind of had like a hard circuit at the end with like a small hill. You know, nothing crazy, 2-minute hill, but it maybe got a little steep. It was just, you know, just tough. And they, as usual, the Euros race way too hard the first time, or like in the beginning of these hills, and it's just exploded at the top and no one really wants to do anything. And so I just like, well, you know, I'll follow this guy. If I'll, you know, hit out here on the top when everybody else is just looking at each other. No one knows who I am. No one's ever seen this rally jersey before. I just look like an off-brand room pot. And so no one's gonna chase me. And then all of a sudden you've got 30 seconds when you really shouldn't. And unfortunately definitely got needed a few more seconds to stay away from Van Aert. But you know, that guy wasn't too upset about that.
This is stage two, right?
Yes.
So you ended up third on that day.
I like a good stage two.
Yeah, that's your day?
You can go back and look. They're all stage two. It's kind of ridiculous.
Well, I mean, to your point of the yellow jersey and that Utah stage having difficulty, you know, often those races, sort of a sprint finish to start, so maybe the leader isn't quite as equipped to handle something lumpy and weird like what you were talking about at Escalante. So I'll remember that if I ever do a stage race, stage two.
Stage two.
Because I like the way you think.
I'm just always going to remember off-brand root pot.
That's good too.
Is that Taco Vanderhorn? No, that's some other guy. Let's let him go.
Best name in pro cycling.
Oh yeah,
right. Yes, thank you.
Love the taco.
Thank you. He's gone to a lot of NL.
Yeah, I mean, world tour rider next
year.
Yeah,
we are big Taco Vanderhorn fans on this podcast.
So when you look at the, you know, your success in breakaways in the domestic circuit, and then moving up to race in Europe this year, and being in lots of breakaways. What are the difference? How is it different to get into a domestic race breakaway versus what you saw in Europe this year?
Well, let's say in the domestic race breakaways, especially some of the bigger races, it's usually like the first or the second move that goes. And so what I would always do is I would just, this is actually an Oscar Clark piece of advice, was just wait until you're absolutely sure that that's the move. And then on the 6-lane highway, just get a good run at the group and just hit it and, you know, make the 30-second to a minute effort and bridge across. And then you're good. You don't have to go with all the extra accelerations. You just sort of wait around and try to be observant and then hopefully have a good 1-minute effort in you. But then the Euro races, for one, you got to be at the front because they will block the road no matter what. They will make an attempt no matter how wide the road is to block it. That's like number one tactic over there for the early part of the race, which is kind of, I don't know. You kind of see that a lot in like Cat 3-4 races when you're growing up. And then when you see it again at like the highest level of the sport, you're like, what on earth? But that's like standard practice now. So one, you got to be at the front. And then sometimes if that first one doesn't go, if they aren't successfully able to like ram everybody else off the road, who's trying to get around them, around the wall, then it's going to be on for like another hour. And then you just got to be fit and still be observant. You can't, you know, if you're over eager, then it's just impossible. And unless you're some sort of a legend like Adam, my teammate, DeVos, you'd be surprised. But he can get into a break, but he doesn't do it by being like with a scalpel. He just does it with a sledgehammer. He just is with every single acceleration and then somehow ends up in there. I'm just trying to be a little more surgical about it. But yeah, once you see them starting to form that wall, you've got about 10 seconds until it's done. And then you've got no chance unless you want to toss somebody into the gutter.
Wow.
So European racing, basically a Cat 3 race.
Exactly.
Except they're much stronger. Not to jump around too much, but actually I wanted to go back real quick to that stage of Tour Denmark. Wout van Aert, someone we keep talking about, especially this year with the way he raced in the classics. I mean, you saw it up close and personal. You were right there with him. What do you think? I mean, is he the type of rider who can actually make an impact on the world tour coming out of a cross background like
that? Oh, definitely. I mean, Denmark was a little bit easier throughout the day. It wasn't like one of those days where you're averaging 280, 300 watts for the entire time. So maybe that's a bit different. But also, I mean, we also did another race with another cross phenom, obviously, Vanderpool,
right,
when you're an Arctic race in Norway. Yeah. And both times those guys, everybody would be going, you know, say it's a sprint, say it's a hilltop, and everybody's ripping it, going as fast as they're going to go, and then they just put it down another gear and right away. Vanderpool did that like two times at Arctic Race, and Van Aert, I mean, they only had that one really tough hilltop at Denmark, but it was the exact same thing. I mean, I had 15 seconds at the bottom of this hill at 1K to go, and it was like evaporated in no time at all.
Man, yeah. Vanderpool, to me, seems like he's got a little more just pure natural talent, which is why it's crazy that he's just going to, at least for now, stick to mountain bike racing and cross, because you could see him like being a real factor in the world tour road.
I mean, maybe he already gets paid enough and it's not really that much of a draw.
I think that's
one of the big things that draws the cross guys to the road is like you get a big pay bump. And, you know, I bet he likes doing those dirt races a lot more.
I think you're right.
I love that finish. One of the people I follow on Facebook like repeatedly posts it online as like some sort of like dramatic finish in cycling, and that of course is stage three of the Arctic Race of Norway.
Yeah, you were one stage too late on that, Robin.
Yeah,
I know, right?
In this stage, Robin's in the breakaway with Adam Tupalik and another rider. And it's thrilling. It's coming into the final few kilometers, get to the base of the climb, you ditch your third breakaway guy, and then it's just on. Take us through that final, I guess, K and a half.
Actually, if I could go back slightly further in that race, because it's kind of hilarious. So that day was Adam's day to get in the break.
Adam DeVos.
Adam DeVos.
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry. Be more specific.
That's okay. We had two Adams.
So that was Adam's day to get in the break, but he was only a minute and a half down on GC in 20th. And I was there just to sort of help him out, get in the break. And we both ended up in it. And then every time you get someone in the break who's like a little high on GC, you end up with someone complaining, maybe a little bit, maybe a lot. Cause you know, if someone's high on GC, the defending team's not going to let you get much time. And then maybe you don't have a shot at actually making it to the finish. And it's just a symbolic gesture. The whole break's just a waste of time. This time we had a break of 10 and there was not one, but two, but eight riders all sitting on Adam and I, all just whining. I've never experienced so much whining in a breakaway about a GC guy being in the break, and they just wouldn't. I mean, it was amazing. The commitment to the whining and the, we eventually just folded. We're like, oh, all right. Well, I mean, at least there's two of us here. If there was just Adam, I think he'd have stuck it out, but.
And so was this like whining in English, like making pleas to you, like, hey, what are you doing?
Yeah, totally. Totally. Oh. Yeah. Anyway, so then Adam eventually dropped back, which was kind of a bummer because that was like the whole plan for the day. But then, you know, kind of ended up going reasonably well. We had a big group and old Mr. Tupalik was the one who whined the least. He was the most quiet, a little sniper. And I should have known better after seeing that. He just kept pulling through and doing his work. And then at the end of that race, he almost dropped me completely the first time up, or the second time up the hill, when it looked like it was getting close and touch and go with the peloton. And so at that point I kind of maybe knew that like this was, you know, we could try, but I he was maybe the better man. And you know, I tried to play a few games up there at the front, coming over the top of the hill, cause it's kind of flat and a little bit of headwind. So trying to make a face here and there, make them think that you're hurting a little more than you are. And of course, they don't. Like I said, they don't know who we are. So if you actually get the benefit of the doubt from them, if you hang back and do a little less work, which is, you know, that's how the game's played. And you see the Euros doing it all the time. I watched the other guy, that third guy, basically making faces as the other guy pulled past him and then going back to sort of like normal race poker face as he pulled in. And then, I kind of overcommitted probably on the hill the last time on the front just because I thought we were going to get caught. And then he just smoked me totally. If I'd been able to stay in the draft, I might have been able to hang on for a second, but I think I got caught with 50 meters to go.
The more and more I watch that, the more I'm like, Adam Tupalik owes Robin Carpenter like a lot of beer or something. Because,
salmon, Arctic Race.
Some salmon. Because I feel like it was your monster pull on the front that allowed him to stay away. If you don't take that pull, he's not getting the stage.
That was almost a bit of a theme for that trip. I did that again at this one-day race in the Netherlands that was called the Koga Slacham Noor. Which is like a crazy gravel race that
really?
No one knows about. Yeah, huh. Yeah. It was not really gravel. I mean, a road race.
Well, sure, but there's
with gravel. It's like kind of a I don't know, like a format like a Strade Bianche or what's that other
Trobro
one?
Trobro. Yeah.
Yeah. Except these guys just decided that gravel meant dumping pea gravel on an asphalt road a week before the race. So, like, it was just all one size stones. So he just sank straight into 6 inches of pea gravel. But anyway, that was another race where, like, I took another guy to the line and, like, almost basically won the race for him because I was being an idiot.
A Roompot guy, in fact.
Yes, indeed.
He probably thought you were on his team.
Old Mr. Narrow Handlebars. I'm sure you've seen him all over the...
Oh, it was that guy?
It was that guy, yeah.
Jan Willem van Schip.
Apparently, he runs those bars because he's a track sprinter, and no one decided to tell me that when I took him to the line in a two-up breakaway.
Yeah, the rally team should more scouting report on that guy next time. Yeah, those bars are crazy. Those are like, what, 34?
At the top, yeah. I think they flare out a bit, but yeah, those. I mean, He's an arrow guy. He's a big guy and he's pretty arrow.
From Amstel Gold Race. He was in the breaker of the front group at Amstel driving it with those crazy bars.
Yeah. Narrow bar guy.
Wow. So, Robin, that speaks to a larger question, and you touched on it here, which, you know, this was Rally's first year in the Pro Continental ranks, and you did a pretty ambitious racing campaign in Europe and also in the Middle East. And so here you are, part of this team that's showing up to these European races for the first time, and other teams don't know who you are. What's the reception like, both on the bike and then off the bike? Like, are people, you know, are the European racers asking you questions? Do they want to know who you are? What's it like for being that American team that just all of a sudden steps into these Euro events?
Well, they don't care about us until you're doing something slightly wrong in the peloton, and then they really care a lot. Which, and that was like, it was kind of funny in Oman, in those Middle East races. It's kind of like racing in California with these giant roads. And these days everybody wants to ride together as a team. Everybody's, you know, no matter what, any part of the race, everybody's riding together. It didn't matter what was happening in the race, where it was or where we were. If we were ahead of some other team in the little lineup in the peloton, they were coming around us. they did not want to be behind the no name American team that they'd never heard of. And that was, you know, that was beginning of the year. And actually, it got a lot better towards the end. You know, that last trip in August, it was a lot of the same teams that we raced against all year. A lot of these sort of pro continental teams, you know, you end up at a lot of the same races. And even some of the World Tour teams. But they start to recognize, like, the kit. And, like, I mean, I thought we did some pretty respectable stuff. Some had some pretty good results. And then, you know, people stop sort of screaming at you for doing something, you know, pretty minor, which was nice. Mm-hmm. And then the race organizers are always like, everybody, all the fans and the organizers are all super friendly. It's really nice.
What did that reception change, or was it impacted at all by the Dubai stage to Hatadam? You and Brandon McNulty famously made it into the early breakaway, and McNulty was, you know, right there for the stage win and just got swarmed with a few meters to go. First of all, what are your memories of that day? And yeah, did that result of that performance change Rally's reputation at all?
It made sure that we were never allowed to have two in the break again at, like, a race with those World Tour teams. We actually forced the issue at Oman the next week. Me and Adam DeVos got in the break again, but we were chased hard for about 10 minutes by some of these teams who were like, you can't have two again. It's not allowed. But that was, yeah, Dubai, that was quite an experience, because you're with all these World Tour teams, all these, like, major sprint teams who are, you know, they can ride the front, they can chase things down, no problem. And it was, I got to credit Eric Wahlberg, our DS, for hatching that plan, because he knew Brandon was going to have a good ride in him somewhere. And if we had two guys, then you knew that you could commit fully, and you'd at least have one other guy, like, fully committed to powering that break. And that was a fun day. It was kind of, like, I feel like we came into Dubai, like, a little out of shape. If I go back and look at the numbers.
Well, it's the start of February, yeah. For crying out loud. It's like, what do you expect?
True, but, man, you'd be surprised at how good those guys are going at the start of February. Like, I was getting dropped like a pure sprinter at Oman up small hills. But, yeah, that was, I mean, my favorite memory actually from that day is that, not even that, I mean, Brandon didn't win, but, you know, that's fine. It was, like, the whole point was that's what makes a race exciting, is that super close catch and it's touch and go and everybody's sort of on the edge of their seats. But immediately after the finish, we all roll down from the top of the dam and we're in this, like, gravel parking lot and everybody's getting into their vans. And none other than Quickstep director Brian Holm, who is, like, kind of known for being a legendary, like, hard ass, rolls up to Brandon and pats him on the stomach and says, hey, you almost got us, huh? That's the last time we let you go. And it was like, oh, man, that's Brian Holm. That's your ticket to the World Tour there, Brandon.
That's pretty cool.
So the running joke for the rest of the week was that Brandon was going to get kidnapped. Brian Holm was going to come up with some chloroform, and we wouldn't see Brandon again until the following year at one of the classics. And he's like, hey, Brandon, how's it going?
Who's that new tall, skinny kid on Quickstep?
Who's Brandon? I am Lars.
Yeah, they reprogram him.
Exactly.
Oh, that was definitely a dramatic day on the bike. So now, Robin, you spent a good chunk of the year racing over in Europe. Then you came back and, you know, had this wedding and you're back in the domestic scene. And, you know, we've talked a lot about the state of the domestic North American scene and some of the storylines going around it, everything from UHC and Jelly Belly to folding to some of the races going away to, you know, just overall kind of a down year looking forward to 2019. I'm curious, what are the discussions like that you have with, you know, former teammates or friends who are racing in the domestic scene? What are people talking about right now?
I guess, you know, people are just talking about what kind of teams are going to be around, who could you even, you know, possibly race for with such a dearth of paid positions. And I think, you know, honestly, you're going to see, I mean, I don't know if it's really going to change too much in terms of who's at the races. I think just you'll have far fewer guys getting paid to be there. I think people will end up getting to those races and traveling to those races no matter what. Cause that's just what you do, what you know. And it's going to be hard to, unless you're like kind of like an older guy who is eyeing up retirement anyway, like these guys are still going to want to be at Redlands. They're still going to want to try to be racing Joe Martin or what have you. I just think that no one's going to be getting paid. Not only because there's no money, but also because it's a buyer's market. And you know, but some of these continental teams are going to have, they'll probably have like 16 riders just cause you can just bring somebody on, give them a bike and two pairs of kit and then and send them on their way for a 10 race day season. So it's I don't know, it's pretty grim. I've never felt so fortunate to have a 2-year contract. Made the change to this team is when I did. But it's also, you know, there was a point where it really looked like, oh man, we're going to have like five fewer teams next year. But then we had Floyd step up, presumably to sponsor Silber, which is great. There's a lot of young riders on that team who are like pretty good and just waiting for like a breakout ride. And then last time I heard Hincapie was still going to be around, just maybe a lot more downsized. So it won't be as grim as maybe what we thought. But you know, I don't know. Some people want to talk about how much of a, I don't know. They want to like, you know, everybody wants to ascribe bigger factors or like ascribe this to a big trend, towards, you know, maybe everybody's, no one likes road racing. Everybody wants to race on gravel or cross or whatever. But I think you see sort of macro cycles like this all the time. Everybody talks about how big like road racing was back when the Coors Classic was happening, sort of in that time period. And then it took a while for us to like get back to like having, you know, another stage race in Colorado. So I don't know. I wouldn't like really engrave the tombstone for road racing in the United States yet, but there's definitely, I don't know, it doesn't look great.
Dane, is road racing dead?
No, no way. Road racing is the best kind of racing. So I will still be here covering it, even if it's just
there you go.
Robin's racing and like one or two other guys not getting paid. I'll still be here. Don't worry.
I'm with you. I follow some of these discussions about, well, you know, gravel is killing the road or, you know, and there's definitely, look, there's something to be said about, you know, from the participatory side. Okay, I want to ride on gravel roads or I want a new change and, you know, the office park criterium is dying. But I'm with you. I want to pump the brakes on some of these notions that, you know, people just don't care about road racing anymore. You know, you look at interest around the Tour de France. You look at VeloNews.com web metrics. You look at a lot of other factors out there that point towards fan interest and even participation interest still being there on the road. Yeah, there's growth in gravel. Yeah, there's new momentum around a return to momentum around mountain bike racing and some of these different types of racing formats. But I don't know. Spencer, do you still ride your road bike?
Yeah, I definitely do. I mean, well, it's interesting too, though. Just recently, the news of EF Education First Dray Pack presented by Cannondale, powered by Rafa. They're going to do some gravel, some mountain biking. Fred, I know you've been talking to some people about that and what it might look like for those races. It's sort of an interesting move as far as like, oh, is this is that going to boost those races? Is it going to affect these riders and their ambitions as road riders? Like, you know, what does that mean? It's curious. And definitely I've talked to some of these riders at the pro continental or continental level who are not going to have a gig for next year, who are pretty seriously considering or actually maybe already planning to do like a mountain bike racing season, going to, you know, these epic rides races that I went to, big money prize purses in those races, that sort of thing. It's I'd say it's not a total. It's not like a. It's not totally a passing fad by any stretch. It seems like there's something afoot. But yeah, I mean, you know, as long as people tune in to watch the Tour de France, there's always going to be that cascading effect of interest in pure road racing.
Yeah, Robin, you gonna be doing fixie crits next year or what?
I will never do a fixie crit. There's absolutely no way. I've seen too many like just heinous videos of crashes, but. I was thinking of making a push maybe to get the team to send me to Dirty Kansas. I don't know. That seems like it could be kind of at least interesting. I don't know. It'd be something different. And I still have yet to do the Belgian Waffle Ride, which is in my basically my backyard.
Yeah.
But it's just a scheduling conflict usually. But, you know, I don't know. It seems like from a marketing standpoint, if you're a sponsor or a team or just trying to build a brand, then it'd be clever to go to those races, in my opinion. And it's, I mean, how much of an investment could it really add? I mean, everybody's already rocking disc brake road bikes. Like, you just throw some fatter tires and send your guy with his race bike and boom, you've got somebody. And as long as you do like some good video and post it to the gram, like you'll be good.
That's what pays the bills. I actually did Belgian Waffle Ride this year. It's pretty fun. Definitely. Nice. It's a weird race in terms of it being just this huge, like, spectrum of terrain where there's a lot of road. So like having a road bike is a big advantage, but then there's like a few sections of legitimately rocky mountain bike trail. And it's just, it's a wrong tool for the job race.
Totally. Which but is, I think that's like the whole point.
That is exactly the whole point of it. But the other thing I think about is if these teams start to emphasize those types of races, you know, eventually if it becomes so popular or if it's so valuable from a social media standpoint, are we going to have kind of a lost generation of American pro roadies who, you know, they paint themselves into this corner and they don't have enough opportunities like you have had to go to Europe and really, really throw down and have some time doing proper European road races to prepare yourself for who knows, maybe you get a world tour ride someday. Maybe you're going to a grand tour or classics or whatever. It's you're not going to learn that by going to Dirty Kansas, unfortunately.
I was just talking with Joe about this a little bit. Joe Lewis, my host for the weekend. And he was like, man, you guys on rally in, you know, 5 years, the only guys you're going to be racing are 18 year olds. You're only going to be racing 18-year-olds on the road. That's it.
Well, it's weird to think about because there was a time in the not-so-distant past when the U.S. domestic league was thought of as the, you know, the minor league, the development ground for going across the pond. And like I said, there was this well-established model of like, oh, if you are the domestic guy who wins a stage of one of, you know, Tour California, Tour Colorado, whatever, or you finish as like the top finishing domestic guy, then that is the proverbial ticket punch, you know, if you're within the right age group and within these all other things, you know, if you have the wattage, which apparently Robin over here, geez, gosh.
I'm just super arrow.
Just so arrow.
Yes. Narrow get those bars. Get those narrow bars.
But, you know, if that model goes away, then I do think that, you know, I think it would be sad. And I don't think that that's something that the cycling community should strive for. We can all talk about disruption and trying new things out, but I do think that keeping the domestic road race scene alive is good.
I think we have not had a big American classic star for quite a while. So maybe on the optimistic end, if people do start doing more Dirty Kansas, more Belgian Waffle Ride, whatever, we could have increased engagement in some of those kinds of races, Strada Bianca. So that's good. Maybe that happens. I mean, you still need to race on the European roads, I think, but it could kind of generate some young American riders who actually know how to handle the bikes in those kinds of rough terrains, and maybe we get a big American classic star sometime.
Well, according to what Robin said over here, since it's all Cat 3 tactics over here, what you do is you get some gravel guy, put him in a bunch of Cat 3 races, and that'll get him
He's ready to go.
Yeah, get Ashton Lambie, the kid with the mustache.
There we go.
Throw him in a bunch of Cat 3 road races, have him do Dirty Kansas, send him to Roubaix. With Robin, he'll be fine.
Boom.
Totally. He's
clearly got an engine. Pursuit.
Oh, yeah.
Pursuit world records, no joke.
Yeah.
Well, guys, before we bail out here, do we have any final questions for Robin Carpenter? Robin, what is your 2019 going to be looking like?
I think pretty similar, except we're trying to wrap in some bigger invites to some bigger races. Maybe some World Tour stage races mixed in there somehow. But I think you'll see somewhat similar. Probably some racing in Spain in the beginning of the year, really getting your ass beat by the Spanish and the Portuguese up every single hill. But I think, yeah, I think we'll probably see something similar. At least I heard we were starting the season again with Valenciana and Oman. So Yeah, it'll be, I mean, it's not kind of nice to do some similar, it's the same races, you learn things a little bit instead of just hopping to something new every time.
Any races we'd like to see Robin in?
Other than the Tour de France, obviously.
Yeah. Well, of course, yeah.
Yeah.
I think you'd do well at maybe one of the like midweek classics, like you know, maybe not full on Tour of Flanders, but one of those.
That would be cool.
Kern Brussels. Yeah.
I'd love to get into some of those. Yeah. It's funny. It was funny discovering at the in that August block that we did that there are a whole set of races that are made for people like me who look like me.
And yeah,
we don't have to go up a mountain every time like we do in America.
What'd you make GP Quebec and Montreal?
Oh, those were excellent.
Yeah,
super cool races. Not only because like you were really, I mean, World Tour race, so you're really with the best guys, and all those guys are the best 1 day racers in the world, getting ready for, you know, ostensibly one of the biggest 1 day goals of the year. So it was quite neat to get that sort of firsthand look at how good these guys can really be. And my takeaway was mostly just that they just can do that same effort that they did 5 minutes in, 5 hours in. That's the biggest part of it. Oof.
Yeah.
Ouch, painful effort. I mean, there's like 15,000 feet of climbing or something like that on this.
Yeah, Montreal was definitely, I think, the hardest race I've ever done, like one-day race I've ever done. It was like a five-minute hill every lap, 16 laps, followed by a couple of like smaller rollers.
Oh.
Yeah, it was...
it's like the world's worst circuit race.
A funny anecdote was my best 5 minute power of the year was the first 5 minutes of that race, because they start at the bottom of the hill.
That's right.
Oh, ouch. God.
Yeah.
But it's a nice hotel you get to go back to, though.
True. So, true. We like the hotels.
Were you guys on trainers warming up for that?
No, I forgot to warm up. Just straight into it cold. Yeah.
That is hard.
Well, Dane wants to see you do the Tour de France, and sick. Spencer wants to see you do like Kern of Brussels Kern. I'm still with like the Alamo last race at last man standing, fixed gear crit, or maybe one of the Red Hooks.
Red Hook, hey.
Just throw you in there.
Dirty Kansas? We'll be out at Dirty Kansas. Come do it.
Yeah. I mean, you never know. We're going to be
sleep
5 years.
Sleep on a couch or something.
Yeah. Everybody's doing Red Hooks and Dirty Kansas. So yeah. That'll be what it's come to.
This disruptive new model of racing. Well, thanks so much to Robin Carpenter for stopping by. Robin,
we'll let you
get out of here. And we would love your feedback on what we talked about today. You can email us at webletters@pocketaftermedia.com. We'll also post links to the stories we talked about today on VeloNews.com. Subscribe to the VeloNews podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play. And while you're there, please leave us a comment and a rating. Become a fan of VeloNews on Facebook at facebook.com/VeloNews Magazine. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/VeloNews. VeloNews podcast is produced by VeloNews, which is owned by Pocket Outdoor Media. The thoughts and opinions expressed on the VeloNews podcast, yes, even Robin Carpenter's, are those of the individual. And as always, we leave you with the Brooklyn Boo Boo Blowout playing the Bernard Petit Classic Soul Drums.